Hey, wie schön, dass du hier heute wieder am Start bist bei den Mindful Sessions, bei deinem Podcast für mehr Achtsamkeit und Soul Power. Und um Power geht es hier heute auch in diesem Interview, nämlich um deine angeborene Superpower, um deine spirituelle Superpower und wie du eben diese entfesseln kannst. Und darüber spreche ich mit einem ganz besonderen Gast, nämlich mit Sarah de Simone. Sarah ist einer der spirituellen Lehrer der Neuzeit. Millionen von Menschen hören ihm weltweit zu. Und das liegt mit Sicherheit auch an seiner ganz individuellen Art zu lehren und zu praktizieren. Er selbst hat bei diversen Meistern im tantrischen Buddhismus gelernt, aber er hat über die Jahre gemerkt, hey, meine spirituelle Praxis muss auch meine Persönlichkeit reflektieren. Die Art, wie ich bin. Und nur so, sagt er, konnte er den Weg in sein spirituelles Erwachen finden, was wiederum alles für ihn geändert hat. Und er ist der festen Überzeugung, dass wir alle diese ganz individuelle Superpower, diese angeborene Superpower in uns tragen und wie wir die entfesseln können. Darüber spricht er jetzt hier in dieser Podcast-Folge und ich wünsche dir ganz viel Inspiration und vor allem Freude mit diesem Interview. I am so happy to introduce and welcome today's guest. I'm very excited also. He is a spiritual teacher, and I just love the way he resonates. I love the way he shines, he teaches, and I love his energy. Welcome, Sarah de Simone.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you so much. Truly so grateful.
Sarah, we just talked before, and what I love about you is really your deep and profound teaching style combined with what you call SaaS. And if I may say, I see some similarities between us because we both learned from Buddhist teachers, and we both like to refer also to scientific evidence, and we both publish our books in Germany with the same publisher. I think yours in April, mine in May. Both teach from the heart, but most important and what really clicks me to you or that clings me to you is I think we both know how it feels to step into a room and be confronted with the reality that there are no other people looking like us and maybe no other people behaving like us. And so we both had to find our own spaces or maybe create our own spaces, create our own teaching styles. And what people call with me the spiritual no bullshit attitude is your spiritual sassy. And yes, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about spiritual sassy. What does it mean to you? And what's it all about?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. And deep breath for all of us who've gone through that mission of not feeling at home in a spiritual space, seeking healing, wanting freedom, wanting to become better versions of ourselves, wanting to access our hearts, but walking into spaces and feeling like, what is this place? Why isn't no one? Why can I not relate to anyone here? You know, why do I feel like I don't belong? Yet again, another space that I feel like I don't belong. So the spiritually sassy is kind of like a big F you, you know, excuse my language, to the community that says that being spiritual, a spiritual seeker and oh my goodness, a spiritual guide, a teacher, could never, you know, laugh too loud, wear certain kind of clothes, speak about certain kind of topics, you know, do things in a way that, that playfulness and lightheartedness and humor were a leading, force, you know, like joy as the pathway to freedom. And what we have seen for spiritual seekers and spiritual teachers historically has been this, what I call this forced seriousness, this zombie zen, where you have to talk in a certain way, you have to act in a certain way. And there is a code of ethics, and there is a moral code that we have to uphold and live by, which is nonviolence. Nonviolence. That's it, honey. And then take care of other people as your way of taking care of yourself. You know, the code of ethics and moral code, is quite simple. You know, take care of yourself, cause no harm, take care of other people. And the expression of that doesn't have to be this forced, seriousness where you kind of become this, what I call the zombie zen. It really, what I felt like I was missing out of the spaces. And there were the seekers, the people who were, you know, on the path to learn. It was amongst, us seekers that I felt like, wow, there is this like this disconnect, this cognitive dissonance of like, our teachers are laughing so much. Our teachers are so playful. They're using humor to access our hearts. They're using, you know, laughter and beautiful symbols and metaphors. And they're showing up to teach in this, in beautiful, decadent, garb, you know, really adorning their temple. But how come we are not allowed? You know, if you veer off to this way or that way, you're no longer spiritual. And I experienced a lot of humiliation, you know, in different temples, in different ashrams, in different monasteries, until the point that I said, you know what? I am done. I realized that like the real important thing is to really access joy and become a blessing factory and enter every room and changing the psychological temperature of every room by just me really existing from that place of joy. And then while I was writing the book, Spiritually Sassy, I had the opportunity of meeting with Venerable Tenzin Palmo, who's, you know, I believe she's a living saint. She's done 12 years in a cave, and she's just a far out, really impeccable teacher. And while I was writing the book, I was really feeling deflated and disillusioned and really disenchanted by the spiritual space and my community. And then she said to me, you know, the seventh paramita, the seventh perfection, which is not in the scriptures, it's what you're here to teach. And I said, what do you mean? She says the seventh paramita is joy, and that's what you're here to do. And I tell the story in the book because it was that story that reminded me that people like us who have access to joy, it's not a joy that we have, you know, come into life with. It's a joy that we have like earned. You know, it's a joy that we have like literally really like really done our best effort to pick ourselves back up. That joy is one aspect of that joy is resilience, right? It's having fought and gone through so many traumatic experiences, so much pain and suffering. And through every one of those hardships really have, you know, cultivated a little bit more of resilience, and through this resilience opened ourselves up to joy. So being spiritually sassy, there's the, you know, depending where you come into it, the first layer of it is just saying, you know, the zombie zen isn't the only path to freedom. If that works for you, God bless, do your thing, honey, live your fantasy, do you, boo. But if you're wanting something that is more poetic, more creative, more visionary, more expressed, which is what I think the queer and people of color need, then, you know, join the Spiritually Sassy movement, you know, and really cultivate that joy and that real, you know, inner freedom in a way that is more irreverent, more audacious, bold. And, you know, we know that our inner freedom will feel the same for all of us, but the outer expression of it will look different. And in the Spiritually Sassy path, all shades of freedom are welcomed. All shades of freedom are a touch point to a community that accepts everyone. And the more expressed we are, the more liberated we are. And therefore we can really just, you know, dance in our, really celebrate our differences. You know, I think that's one thing that I was like really missing in the space. And another aspect of it is the joy. I feel like people forgotten the purpose of the healing journey and the spiritual path. It's like, honey, what happened to your joy? Like we are meant to be smiling more, laughing more, be more playful, more lighthearted. Like these are attributes of a liberated mind and an open heart. These are qualities that we are meant to have to start to actualize. And I lost that during my journey, you know, and I lost touch with that because I was like following this other archetype of spiritual seekers. And yeah, so that's a little bit about spiritually sassy. It's really about being audaciously yourself and really bringing forth joy, you know.
Thank you.
And yes, honey.
I just absolutely love it. And
as you said, you know, spiritual sassy is not a quick fix. It's not like we were born like, oh, I'm just smiling all the time. It's something we really, really earned. It's like bringing the unconsciousness to light, bringing the trauma to light, working with the trauma. It's not this spiritual bypassing and saying, oh, everything is always positive and I'm always feeling good. No, it's like acknowledging, yes, I have my broken parts. Man, I have my broken parts. And they're a part of me and that's okay. And I can befriend them and it's okay to not be okay. But it's also okay to feel joyful, to feel playful. And why I can relate so much to you is like what you said, you know, it has so much to do with the bodhicitta, the awakened heart, the awakened mind, to see like everyone has a maybe a different way of living and how to express inner and outer freedom. But actually, it's we are all the same, you know, in a way. Our fears, the fear of not belonging, the fear of not being good enough, all this like blah, blah, blah. You call it Blanca, your inner critic. you know, we all have our Blanca. And to say, okay, that's me. I'm vulnerable. I'm open. You know, this is it. I don't have to hide that anymore. I don't have to hide that I was hurt and that I'm hurting. Probably also, yes. And I'm just doing my best, but I have the right to live a joyful life. And even pain can be part of joy in a experience, in a human being, in a living, breathing heart. And how did you access your... because... I start differently because I love how you say spiritual sassy is something light, playful, but it's not a quick fix. And how did you opened up to your unreleased trauma? What was like, you know, because a lot of people are scared and I get it absolutely, but we are more scared of the being scared. To look at these parts and we think, oh, if I look at this part of myself, I'm going to die. Probably I'm going to die because we have been holding up 30, 40 years to not look at this part and to not show this part to other people. And what would you suggest is like the first step to be like this fucking bold and say, okay, I'm going to look at this part that I've been hiding like for my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Such a great question. And really that was, you know, this is really like when I answer this question and I really like take a moment to like breathe into it and really go back to that really hurting version of myself, the version of me that was anxious and depressed and suicidal and addicted and just really confused. And I was hurt. So therefore I was hurting other people and the cycle of pain was just continuing. It was really two things. First, recognizing that we are basically good. You know, that's something that the Buddhist path has offered me. It's the recognition that we have this basic goodness, that goodness is a seed that is inside all of our hearts. And that seed, unlike any other seed in the garden of our mind, cannot be destroyed, cannot be unearthed, cannot be weeded out, can only be developed. You know, the seed of suffering, the seed of jealousy and anger and despair and confusion, depression, all these other seeds that are in the garden of our mind, they can be removed. And that's what the Buddhist path proposes. That's the journey back into the heart, is actually deleting, eradicating, removing these aspects of ourselves and really developing the true nature of who we are, what's there at the base of our being. And I actually, growing up a person of color and queer and then going to the spiritual spaces, I was just like, oh my God, there's so much. I can actually have this confirmation bias that I'm broken, that I'm bad, that I don't belong. So it was this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that I, you know, I had this internalized homophobia towards myself and this kind of like feeling, you know, all the ways that I didn't feel like I belonged and all the ways that I was hurting, entering the world with that view of myself just created the self-fulfilling prophecy that these spaces didn't support me, that the world didn't support me, that the world was not a safe place, that nothing was going in my favor, and I don't belong here, so I should probably unalive myself. And it wasn't about me immediately changing the behaviors of me changing this mindset and changing these thoughts. It was actually me really having a meditation on the basic goodness, on this heart that we have this basic goodness, that our mistakes are not who we are. Their mistakes are not who they are. Their past do not define who they are at the base of their being. This doesn't take away the pain that it was caused. You know, karma's watching everything and documenting everything. So live it up to karma, honey. And it's very important to recognize that we have this basic goodness. And that basic goodness then helped me to stop putting myself in danger and hurting myself, because I thought that because I wasn't innately good, this was the plot twist. There's two parts. I'm going to tell you the second part. But the plot twist was because I felt like I was not innately good, that I wasn't a good person, that I wasn't innately a genuine, loving, kind, deserving human being, I then felt the need to course correct myself into being good. The way to course correct yourself is by punishing yourself. Look at our justice system. Look at the way we have prisons and the way we approach anyone who does anything that we perceive to be a mistake or something wrong. In our mind, silently, when we're driving, we see someone doing something that we perceive to be wrong or bad or inadequate on the streets. We're immediately, in our mind, we're punishing them. We're putting them in prison. We're putting them in a correctional facility. We're doing something in our mind that's punitive, you know, because we perceive that it's through a punitive approach by punishing someone that they can be course corrected into becoming good. And we do this in our own inner world too. We do this to ourselves. We do this with addiction. We do this with our depression. We do this with our anxiety. We do this with every area of our lives. We are, you know, misinterpreting this idea that we have to be course corrected into reawakening our goodness. Our goodness cannot be, we don't need to be course corrected through self-destructive behaviors of punishing ourselves to awaken it. It's there because we are there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just recently I read an article about, I don't know, a tribe, I don't know the name anymore, but they are like, if someone did something wrong in their community, they are not punishing them. They are like all coming together to show the person, hey, you are loved. You've been whole. We hold you. And I was thinking, okay, that's a great, great thing, because we are raised with punishment. Our system functions with punishment. And as you said, our mind is conditioned to punishment, punishing ourselves, punishing others. And what a great way to, if someone makes a mistake, yes, to say, hey, we don't punish you. We don't isolate you. No, we show you we are here and we help you to make things right. And you don't have to have this fear that we reject you, because this fear of rejection is, that's actually, like, for me, it's the source of my problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, through NVC, nonviolent communication, they say that the number one need that we have is to belong, right? So the fear of being rejected and not belonging, and belonging is one thing. Now, belonging as our true self is a whole nother thing, you know? So walking into the space as your true self and experiencing belonging from that place, that is real miraculous. That's truly spiritual audacity there. So the... experiencing the basic goodness was the first sort of glimpse of a change. And I was like, oh my God, what I've been sort of, you know, tripping in my mind, believing about myself isn't the truth. Because if I am innately good, then the ways I've been internalizing my mistakes, the way I've been internalizing the ways I've been hurt and the ways other people have hurt me isn't really all that bad and isn't really all there is to someone and myself. There's so much more to it. And then that opened the door to forgiveness. So the two things when someone asks me, what do we do when we are afraid of entering the valley of shadows, of dancing with Mara, of walking into meeting our darkness and actually, as we say in Buddhism, having tea with our demons, right? It's through recognition that we are basically good, and then through the practice of forgiveness. And forgiveness was the first chapter. I believe it's chapter 4 in the book, but it was the first chapter that I wrote for the book because it was through the practice of regret and repair within myself and to the world that something changed. And the practice of forgiveness, we have to recognize that it's an independent practice. And although we know through the spiritual perspective and through science, there's nothing independent in the world. Everything is interdependent. Science proves it. Spirituality proves it. All mystical traditions prove that everything is interdependent, interweaved together. So when we do the practice of forgiveness from our side, I forgive myself, please forgive me, I forgive you. When we go through these three pillars, we are shaking the web non-verbally, non-physically, you know, you can't see with the eyes in your face, but you're shaking the web that we're all connected to. And you have to recognize that the mystical traditions that have been here way before all of this, you know, way before social media, way before any of this stuff, you know, the stuff that's been here for thousands of years has shown that, you know, that really accessing the heart field has a physiological and miraculous impact in everything around us. So the practice of forgiveness, people are like, oh, so do I have to like write the letter to the person that hurt me? And do I have to write the letter to the person that I hurt? And do I have to go up there and step on a soapbox and read it? And it's no, you don't. What you need to do is do it between you and you first. And then you have to like have faith in the natural law of justice, which is the natural law of karma, which is cause and effect, right? The consequence of love is joy. The consequence of lack of forgiveness is anger, is despair. The consequence of every single moment of despair and every single moment of anger and every single moment of jealousy and every single moment that you're believing that your pain is who you are and that you're believing that their mistake is who they are. Every moment that you spend in that has a consequence. We believe, we think about consequences only as bad, but there are positive consequences. Like the action of sitting in an afternoon, drinking up a cup of coffee, lighting up an incense, putting some beautiful music, dressing really comfortably, and writing these self-forgiveness letters and forgiveness to other people and asking for forgiveness, doing this work between you and you, and then burning these letters, you have to open yourself up to something that's beyond what meets the eye. You know what I mean? So basic goodness and forgiveness, it is literally the opening door for the experience of liberation. And the forgiveness part is, excuse my language, but it's very freaking hard. It is really difficult to go through a grudge detox, to actually recognize all the ways that you've hurt other people and really feel deeply the regret and really go to the depth of your regret and make a vow once you reach the edge and say, I will not make the same mistake. You know, for the duration of this life, I will not commit the same mistake. It's it says that through the literature and the scriptures, it's like And it's and I'm paraphrasing everything I say that's more on the canonical traditional text. I'm paraphrasing. It's the depth of your regret will show you the depth of your liberation. You know, so the more you experience deep regret for the harm you've caused, the more you're actually going to be able to expand your heart, crack your heart wide open, even wider. And then you do have to come to terms that people change because you're changing. So are they. They hurt you, but that isn't who they are. It's too hard to understand, right? It's like, I don't want to believe that. But if you want to call yourself someone who's on a spiritual path, on a healing journey, the nectar of forgiveness has to be second nature, has to be with you every step of the way. It has to be on your spiritual fanny pack. There's too many people who neglect forgiveness. And I just believe it's because they don't know what it truly means. You know, to forgive is to release the desire to punish. It goes back to what we talked about earlier. To say, I forgive you. It just means I no longer want to punish you for the harm you've caused me. Because I recognize that you are hurting. And we also know that only those who are hurting hurt other people. Because if you're at ease with yourself, if you're relaxed and at peace with yourself, you know that the self, that yourself is the other. That this interdependence fabric that we are all connected to, as you hurt somebody else, you're hurting yourself. So it really comes down to like this, the recognition that forgiveness is a choice to stop the cycle of pain. And it was really hard to realize, oh my God, I have caused harm. I was in a 30-day meditation retreat, and I actually had a really challenging, experience to the point that I packed my bags and I was getting ready to leave because of that, you know, coming to terms with the harm you've caused the world and then coming to terms with the harm that others have caused you and experience that deeply. It's really challenging, but that is a foundational aspect, a grudge detox, entering the state of forgiveness. And we have to recognize and that it is an art. It's not a one-time deal. You are going to spend months and years. I'm coming up to 10 years of practice, and there's still parts of myself that I haven't forgiven. You know, there's still people that I still haven't forgiven. And the way I know if I have forgiven myself for them is when the memory surfaces my mind, is my nervous system all jacked? Is my breath shallow? Is my mind now going to a spiral, or does it arise and does it pass like a cloud? Come and go. Very simple. I don't add any additional stories. It doesn't trigger my chemistry. It doesn't disorient my mind. It doesn't make me leave the present moment. It doesn't make me seek external quick fix like a cigarette, like alcohol or drugs or even chocolate. There's everything that we believe to be harmless. When you are experiencing a traumatic flash in your mind and you seek out for that, you're reinforcing the narrative that of a quick fix, that external things can make me better, right? So this is kind of like, you know, just a little bit of something that's in the book that I really, it's like when people come to that chapter, they either close the book or they say, thank you, bye. Oh, they say, you know what, honey, I'm gonna freaking do this thing, and I'm gonna like march through it, because if you did it, I can do it. If you walk through the Valley of Shadows, I can walk through it too, you know.
And there is so much to find in our inner shadows, like shadow work, you know, it's so precious. It's not something we should like lock away. And as you said, it's you have to be bold. It hurts. It's work. Every moment in our lives gives us the new chance to do that work. This is something beautiful, I find. And actually, it's for me, it's to access our true nature. You call it awakening. You know, we always think, or there's this misbelief, misunderstanding, to awaken, we have to be better or a better student, or have to gain more knowledge, But actually, to awaken means to get to the pure nature of ourselves, of being a human, right? It's not being better, being more smart or whatever. It's about, hey, it's what the word says, wakening up. It's like for 1 second. And I think sometimes we have this, either people who practice, but also I think everyone, even people who don't practice, sometimes we have a glimpse, this moment where we feel, ah, yes, I'm awake. It's like we are sitting in a dark room and then we realize for maybe just a second, oh, I can turn on the light myself, right? And this is, it's not being more, it's not being better. It's like connecting or getting access to our true nature with beyond all the stories, like you said about forgiveness, not telling a different story and blaming or pushing things away or holding on things, on regrets, just to the essence. And this is on the, what amazes me all the time is it's something, yeah, we have to do less, not more, but on the same time, it's so much work, you know? And what I find beautiful is like every moment of our life gives us the chance to wake up or to work on wakening up, to be our pure nature and to see how am I as Sarah outside all the boxes I put myself into, all the conditioning, all the stories I'm telling myself about myself, telling myself about other people. Who am I outside all these boxes, all these labels I put myself in, you know?
I love that so much. Mm. Thank you for saying that. One thing I've been, you know, reminding myself and people often is the fact that when you are walking down the streets and people are like, what does it mean to be compassionate? And what does it mean to actually carry yourself in a state of compassion? And as you're saying, this came up for me. It's this, the simplicity of entering the world with compassion to me means that you recognize that everyone, just like you, suffers and wishes to be happy. And the recognition, not this desensitized world that we have, you know, that we're living in right now, where the movies have become so gory and the music has become so strange and not Berlin strange, which I love, you know, trust me, j'adore Berlin, honey. I love everything about all the things about Berlin. And I'm totally a freak and a weirdo, but there is this kind of need to just turn things up to this constant next level to get something out of, for us to feel something, for us to experience something, because we're so desensitized, because we have been okay with things that are not okay. We have been really living in our shit for so long that we call that home when that isn't truly home. There's a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm paraphrasing again, says that we are so familiar with our pain and our suffering that to do anything different is more scary, that we would rather stay in our shit. Thich Nhat Hanh would never say that. So, you know what I mean? So we would rather stay in our shit than to actually experience the unknown, which is the peace, the kindness, the relaxation, the joy. But entering the world and the world through a compassionate state of mind is actually being able to touch, you know, lightly touch the sadness and the grief that we all are experiencing constantly, simultaneously knowing that every single one of us has the capacity to become liberated. Can you see everyone as a Buddha? Can you enter the world? And when I'm stressed and I'm not in my spiritual guide, artist, yogi, mystic mindset, and I'm lost, you know, and it happens frequently that I get lost, but the coming back isn't, the journey coming to come back to this state of mind isn't so far anymore. That's what 10 years of practice have given me. It's just I can come back a little bit quicker, but I still fall off. It's just the pause, the breath, and then I really see everyone. I do my best effort to see everyone as a Buddha. People who are fully awakened. These are gods and goddesses, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. These are saints and sages in this whole room, in the supermarket that I'm so annoyed. Everyone here is a Buddha. They all have something to teach me. They can all show me my way back home. And that is entering the world through a state of compassion, because touching that in you, really, you know, we've heard this a million times, but everything's a projection of our mind. We're only seeing the world through the quality of our own inner state. So when we have this inner state going on and we see the world through that perspective, there is just this big shift. And I don't know how this is related to what you're saying, but that's what came up for me. It was like compassion.
I absolutely get it. And I was just reminded about the practice, and I think there's also a movie, Everything is Enlightened. And I like this practice, like I'm going through my day, as you said, and I see like the world by like everything is enlightened. I'm the only person on the whole planet that is not enlightened. So every human being, whatever they do, they're doing it to guide me through to my enlightenment.
Oh my God, I love this.
To make me wake up. And the whole universe, you know, not only people, but everything I see. And there are two so beautiful things, like compassion, what you said. I see everything. Everyone teaches me a lesson to help me to wake up in the most soft and most beautiful way. And secondly, everything I see is a miracle, you know, everything is enlightened. I see the flowers, they are enlightened. Everything is beautiful. It's not like I'm just rushing my way to the train station and going through my day, rushing to my day. No, everything is enlightened. And everything, every aspect of my day, every living, breathing thing is helping me to wake up and the most beautiful way.
I love that so much. You took the seeing everyone as a Buddha to the next degree. I love that so much. Wow, thank you. And to the listener, you know, I encourage I invite everyone to try to spend, you know, one afternoon or one day in a state of mind like that and just watch what happens. Remember, we talked about the everything, the natural law of justice, the karma, whatever you want to call it, cause and effect. There is a consequence. Imagine spending an entire day in that state of mind. What the impact that would have, you know?
And because we're talking about awakening, in your book, Sassy Spiritual, in German it's Sensationell Spirituell, you describe the 8 steps towards awakening. You say, and I quote you, okay, my love, so the way I designed it, the steps are meant to be followed one after the one because they build on each other. The graduation adds to your awakening. And can you like maybe, yeah, guide us through this 8 steps?
Okay, I'm going to be fully honest. I don't remember all the steps one by one right now. But what I do have is what I do remember from the book and from my own inner world, from what's, you know, from writing the book, like so much changes, right? You come into it with this idea and this vision. And then as you're writing it, things change. And now that it's being published in Germany, it's been a couple of years.
Ah, okay. But I have them here.
Okay, so tell me about it. Yes, tell me and then I'll tell you about it. Yes,
exactly. Step one, know your story to change your story.
Mm-hmm. And this step is actually like, it's really about taking responsibility. Like, how have you lived? You know, how have you lived your life? Like, what are the parts of your story that you're afraid of, that you're ashamed of, that you've neglected and avoided, and that you are unwilling to talk, not even to your therapist? You know, I think people even filter what they share with their therapist because they're so afraid of not even belonging to that therapy relationship. So this is the unfiltered look at your biography so far. That's the first step. And the book is a practice book, so you're going to have many different prompts to get you to feel comfortable enough to actually, like, you know, like, it's okay. It's okay, honey. It's okay. Let's do this work, you know? So that's step one.
Step two, we just talked about it. Learn to forgive yourself and those motherfuckers who have hurt you.
Yeah. And the forgiveness chapter, the forgiveness step, it's everything we've talked about before. It's like a vital piece to, you know, I remember first time one of my spiritual teachers said, Sah, come back into the present, you know, come back to the present. And I had no context for presence because I haven't experienced it. I hadn't never glimpsed at the actual beauty and grief that the present moment holds for us, you know, this kind of grief and gratitude, this kind of grief and beauty, this beautiful letting go and seeing it new, you know, that's all happening simultaneously. Because every single time I would sit down to practice, my past will come rushing into my mind. I would just be flooded with memories. I would just be flooded with all the ways that I've been hurt and all the ways that I've hurt other people. And so I had no context for presence. So forgiveness, through the practice of forgiveness, I slowly, slowly, slowly started to experience, oh, this is what presence feels like. Oh my goodness, I like this. This is nice. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Step three, spray spiritual bleach on the belief systems that have kept you stuck.
This is really a challenging one, because if we take an opportunity to, like, really enter the world with a little notebook, just a tiny little notebook and a tiny little pencil, and we are actually able to, you know, see a person of color or a queer person or someone who has a different kind of hair or a different kind of body or drives this kind of car or wears this kind of clothes or drinks this kind of thing or behaves in a certain kind of way or listens to this kind of music, anything that's happening out there. If you want to really understand who you are, not the truth of who you are, but who is the symbolic self built on? What are the preferences that the symbolic self is built on? Look at all the belief systems that you have. A person of color, I have this belief about them. Oh, a queer person, I have this belief about them. Someone who listens to this kind of music, I have this belief about them. Someone who drives this car, I have, like, literally, if you actually become a scientist about your liberation, if you approach your liberation, your awakening, as a scientist would, with the microscopic precision, honey, beautiful things happen, but it does require you to actually, like, sit in a coffee shop and just kind of, like, you know, do an open eye practice that I call, and just really, like, there and just take it in. What is it? What is the conditioning? What is the belief system that you have around every single thing that you see? And then you start to see the hooks. You start to see the knots. You start to realize how unfree you really are at a mental level. You know, but then it's in a moment of pause that you can breathe and, like, actually start to rewrite that belief system. But that chapter happens when we are actually, like, already started to clean up the house a little bit, which with the forgiveness chapter, you know.
Mm-hmm. Step four, wake up your inner wisdom.
This one is really about recognizing that we do have this inner guru, you know, inside of us. Like in tantric Buddhism, there is devotion and non-duality, right? And pure perception. And devotion leads to non-duality. And I'm just going to give you just a tiny little teaching here, just so people understand. It's like, you practice this kind of, like, devotion to a deity, to a god, to a Buddha outside of you. You really say, oh my God, dear teacher, dear guru, you know, show me the way. Please show me the way. Guide me. All of your qualities, I want to have them too. That's devotion, right? Being devoted to. And then on the other side of it, through this experience of devotion, you awaken the pure perception, the non-duality, where you recognize that there's really no separateness. There's nothing separate from yourself, that everything that you're seeing outside of yourself, the guru, the teacher, the Buddha that you are calling in front of you or saying that's in front of you, is really inside of you already. Because anything that you can see, all the qualities that you see in somebody else, or in a teacher, and a guru, and a god, or a deity, whatever it may be for you, is already inside of you. So that step is to trust that you have access to this cosmic wisdom, and to know that when you're listening to that wisdom, you're actually tending to the needs of the heart versus the desires of the mind. And there's very specific practices in there to get you to differentiate. It's like, when am I listening to this, to the inner wisdom, versus when am I listening to my neurosis, you know? So there's a very clear distinction there, you know?
Yeah, and actually it's spraying spiritual bleach in our belief system is like cling to wake up your inner wisdom. Because when I see that I'm a goddess because I see goddesses, it's the same, like, but if I shrink people into boxes because I label them, because I think, okay, because they are queer, they must be in a certain way, then I shrink myself into boxes, right? The more I get other people out of boxes in my head, I can enter the inner wisdom.
Yes. Oh my God. Beautiful. And I love that you said that like, the more you put people in boxes, the more you are putting yourself in these psychological prisons. And more you're actually like, you know, not getting free, honey. That's really what it is.
Shrinking ourselves in this little jail cells in ourselves, yeah. Right? Yeah. Step 5, name your superpower.
This is when we recognize that we have a gift, you know, that we have something to offer, that the depth of our liberation will dictate the depth of our contribution, that the more free we are, the more freedom we will bring into the world, that we recognize that our superpower may be our pain point, our wound, all of our challenges, maybe it's through our mess that we may, you know, really awaken our message, you know, and maybe it's through the most karmic patterning in our lives that we are going to discover our dharma, you know. For me was actually through my challenges with mental health and experiencing all kinds of different states, and really saying, oh my God, this is like literally my pain is depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, addiction, and wanting to become free, wanting to actually like be a researcher, a scientist about what causes this and how do I get free from it. And that really was what oriented my life to a life of service towards helping other people to become free too. So this chapter is also, this step is also a reminder that naming your superpower it's not necessarily, that everyone has to have a spiritual podcast and become a spiritual teacher and a yoga teacher. Well, like whatever, like, literally, if you read about the lives of the Mahasiddhas, these radical saints that lived in India thousands of years ago, you really realize that it's about this regarding convention. Once again, it's about you can actually make jewelry that is touching grace. When I see you wearing this beautiful piece of jewelry, I'm immediately connected to my heart. I'm immediately opening myself up to a state of beauty. And when I experience inner beauty, what do you see in the world? You see beauty. So then you're going to be a kinder person. Maybe you're making a latte, you know, and you're blessing. You may be a barista and you're blessing the coffee, and you're really like bringing that inner miraculous blessing factory state of mind into everything you do. So then everything that's the way people engage with what you make from that place will be beneficial. So that is a contribution. It doesn't have to look like how it looks for you and how it looks for me. This is just our current expression of it, you know.
I love that you're saying this, because I love what I'm doing, and I'm sure you love what you're doing. But also, sometimes people get the perception you have to like be a spiritual teacher, or you have to be recognized by other people, you know, in a like on this all these things like social media, and you are living your superpower when you have a big audience. And this is then also so much with the ego, right? And I'm always checking myself. Like, is that what I'm doing? Like, is it my ego? Like, before I started my podcast, I went to my Buddhist teacher. He's like 80. And I'm like, hey, I don't know if I'm allowed to put these teachings out there. Or like, let's be honest, on social media, you know, I'm talking about like spirituality, but and this ancient traditions. And at the same time, I'm posting every day like a picture of myself, and it's all about myself, you know? And he said, you know what? As long as you ask yourself these questions, go out there and do what you're doing, you know? But it's also misleading sometimes, because everyone has a superpower. And you know what? My superpower, my superpower maybe isn't my teaching. My superpower is like to be a good mother, maybe, or to be a good listener, to be a good friend, right? So it has something also very like, it's maybe it's just between two people, maybe no one like outside the world sees it, like maybe just the one person who's in need, and you take your time and listen to this person. Or you're cooking, like you're taking care, you're cooking for your partner or whatever, you know? So it's not something everyone has to recognize, you know? It's like the one heart maybe you touched, and maybe, that's it. And one light, one single light can light up like the world of someone in that moment. And that's why I love what you said, because I think we really have to like, it's a responsibility also, right? Because I see that a lot, that people say, yeah, but I haven't found my superpower, and people are not recognizing me. It's not about getting recognized from the outer world, you know? And it's the small, every act of kindness can be a superpower, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, two things come up for me, like a quote from Mother Teresa: not everyone could do great things, but everyone could do, I'm paraphrasing it, but the essence of the quote is not everyone's going to be able to do things that are going to be super large in impact, but we all have the capacity to do, you know, small things with great love. That's the essence of something that she said that really touched me deeply. And then I also just have to say one thing too. It's like, what is in your vision board? You know, because a lot of people may look at like, oh, you've worked with all these celebrities, you've done all these things, you blah, blah, blah. I'm like, honey, let me tell you something. I never put any of these people that I've worked with on my vision board. I literally, what I put in my vision board is Mother Teresa, is literally all the saints and sages that I practice, that I aspire to walk their on their footsteps. Literally a micro little bit that I get to do that. That's really like what my bodhisattva vow to be, of help to all sentient beings for as many lives as it takes. That is what that is. And then through that disciplined desire to help people to become free, then I get the call to go work with this person and fly to this thing and do that thing and then go to this show and speak to this person, teach this person and do that thing. But it was never about that. And people see the followers and they see the numbers and they see the TV and the magazine. Da, da, da. I'm like, honey, none of that is what's been on my vision. Like, the vision was, can I get free as quickly as possible to help as many people get free as quickly as possible? When the orientation of your liberation is all there is for you, then how life will support you, how you, the opportunities will show up in ways that are beyond your wildest dreams. And also, I say this from one side, and on the other side, it is really like about doing the small things with great care, with great love, the way you said it. It's like, maybe you're a mom and you're a really good mom to your child, and you're not listening to the capitalistic world that says, leave your child crying until they stop crying. But you are saying, no, after this, I know that it's truly by picking up my child when they're 6 months, I'm going to cry if I continue saying that. But it really is like picking up your child and holding them and taking care of them and loving them so deeply in the way that they feel so secure, you know, and so safe in your arms that they enter the world feeling safe and secure, that then they are going to enter the world and bring that into the world. Not actually like following the norm and creating people that believe that they're independent. And, you know, anyways, all I'm saying is, please do small things with great love, as Mother Teresa said, that will support you to create the conditions and the consequences for something, for your wildest dreams, for your most, you know, beautiful prayers to be answered. But stop holding on to the outcome. Stop seeing social media as the truth and the reality. Stop it. Followers and likes and all this stuff is not the end all, honey. Like, trust me. Like, my life is still fucking crazy. My mom has cancer for the third time. You know, like, things are still happening in the same way. It doesn't matter how much follower I have and how many viral videos and da da da. No. Focus on doing things and focus on getting local. I'm glad we brought this up, but focus on getting local. Like, help the unhoused people in your neighborhood. Go out and feed them. Take care of them. You know, you've taken care of your mom. You've taken care of your father, your parents, your kids. You've taken care. There's extra food. Put it in a beautiful little Tupperware and bring it to the unhoused person down the street with a little note and a bottle of water. And take a moment to look directly into their eyes and say, God bless you. Buddha blessings to you. I hope you to become free. You know, your freedom is important to me. I care about you. Like, literally take a moment to do that. See how that changes your reality. See how caring for the people that will give you nothing. That is one other thing that people ask me. So how did you choose? How did you walk off the edge of unaliving yourself? Because you've walked the valley of shadows and you've talked about suicide so many times. How did you walk yourself back? I had a vision. I had a mystical experience that my guru appeared to me and she says, go be of service. I said, I have nothing to offer. I'm dead inside. I'm in so much pain. I feel like I just don't want to be here anymore. I have nothing to offer the world. She says, you want the depression gone? You want the suicidal thoughts gone? Go be of service. And I was like frozen in that apparition, in that vision, in that mystical experience. But I said, all right, if I have any faith in this, in anything that I'm studying, if I have any faith in the saints that I've met in India, if I have any faith in this guru that I lived at her ashram in the south of India, if I have any faith that any of that is truth, I'm going to go be of service. So I literally made some sandwiches and brought it to a park where people were dropped off after they've been in prison. And I was trembling. I was fearful. But I experienced just a tiny little glimpse of relaxation in service to other people, you know? So I don't know how we got onto this, but yeah, that.
Thank you so much for all of that. Thank you so much. Really, it's, thank you. Okay. Step six, believe you are amazing.
Yeah. This step is the, about imposter syndrome. The imposter syndrome is the witch wound. The witch wound. All of us witches, all of us who are, you know, bringing healing into the world, are wanting to help other people in the smallest ways, in whatever way, you know, big or small ways. The witch wound is, and I don't speak about the witch wound in the book. I speak about it now because I actually, after writing the book and talking about that for so long, I realized that it's really this idea that if I share my gifts with the world, I'm going to actually be killed for it. You know, like the witches were burnt. You know, if I share healing with other people, if I help other people, if I share my elixir and my essence and my, you know, my ways of helping people, they're non-traditional, they're non-conventional, I'm going to be killed for it. So the imposter syndrome will show up The moment that you step out of your comfort zone, the moment that you start to contribute to the world, the moment that you start to like share yourself with the world a little bit more than you did yesterday and a little bit more than you did a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, anytime you step out of your comfort zone, you will experience this kind of like pushback of, oh, I'm not okay. Things are not okay. I'm scared. I should go back to my comfort zone. I don't deserve to share my gifts. My gifts are not needed. You know, people don't need it. Honey, that step to believe that you're amazing is literally one of the things, like when I talk about forgiveness as being, something that has to be in your back pocket with you all the time. You know, when you go through like your favorite jeans in your closet and you find a $20 bill in there, that is what I'm talking about. It's that old crumbled up $20 bill that is always in that pair of jeans. That's old and it's been there. It goes to the laundry and comes back and still there. That is what I'm talking about. It's to believe you're amazing. It's a constant practice. You know, every time I step on stage, I have a tremendous fear. Even before I came on here, I was like, okay, breathe. And I was painting and then I get a notification. Oh, in 30 minutes, you have a podcast. And I was like, oh my God, I have a podcast. And I was like, girl, relax. You have something to offer. Breathe into that. I have something to offer. I have a gift to bring into the world. So that's that step.
Love it. Love it. And can absolutely relate. Like every time I'm going to stage, on stage, I'm like, oh God, if I would have the option, I would run away. Right?
yeah, exactly.
Okay, step 7, use what you have.
Use what you have is activate your resources. I think we think like, oh, when I have the follower, it goes back to what we said earlier. When I have those amount of followers, I can help people. When I have this house, I can host people. When I have this car, I can go to that place. When I have this amount of money, I can go to this thing. This step is really about like looking at what you already have, and you're going to be surprised at how many resources you have, you know? And also like this step is also about shifting your priorities, you know, like, how many times have you saved up money to buy things that you don't need to impress people that you don't like? You know, how many times you've literally like put more money into a car or to a house or to a pair of shoes or a bag or whatever, or change your hair or whatever, things that are you're just doing to sort of present yourself in a coherent way to the world. But the truth is, you actually wish you could be saving up money to come on retreat and to go to a sacred site or to take a week off and being silenced, you know, like that step is about reprioritizing your life and looking at the resources that you have. And it's really an amazing thing when you go through the steps on that and that, when you go through the practice on that step, you actually realize that you have a distant cousin who is a published author who can actually give you guidance on like how to write that book, that you actually have a friend of a friend who started a podcast and they can help you to start a podcast too. They can tell you what the equipment that they need. And that step, I tell the stories, of the fact that my inner circle of my closest friends are all people that I met on the internet, you know? All people that I reached out when I came back from India feeling sort of lost and really energized, but lost and energized. And I reached out to people on the internet and I said, hey, I love what you're doing. Can I have some guidance? Can we meet for coffee? And I got to tell you, like at least half of the people that I wrote not only met with me, but they, and I didn't have any followers, honey. It was literally just like the inner guidance. I met with them and not only they gave me guidance, not only they supported me, but they also became my friends. That is the thing that I say. But I say this to people and then people go out and reach out to people who are in a completely different stage in their personal evolution, completely different stage in their career. That gap, you got to be aware of that gap, honey. You know what I mean? Be conscious about that gap, but still reach out. You know, drop in and like really do a spiritual dowsing. Like, is this the right direction? Is this the right person? And you're going to realize that, you know, these are your people. And it's amazing to look at like my phone book and see how all these people that I was a fan of, are friends that I call when I'm in despair and I'm lost and I'm in deep grief, you know? And I think we have a last step, right?
Yes. Stay slaying.
Stay slaying. This is about the foundation pillars, the foundational pillars to get you to keep going. And it's really about, you know, looking at all the things, like this step is really about like maintenance and discipline and just saying, honey, it just requires discipline. And it requires a discipline that is devotional, that is sweet, that is tender, that is grateful, but it requires upkeeping. Like you, and we've heard this a million times, but I have to say it again. It's like, you don't go to the gym once and you get your body strong. You gotta go to the gym constantly. And this inner gym requires training, requires real maintenance. It's the same thing. You leave a garden, even if it's you came into this garden and you're like, oh my gosh, the most beautiful garden. Look at all these beautiful roses, the most beautiful flowers I've ever seen in the world. And everything's manicured and so beautifully trimmed and it's gorgeous. And you don't go into that garden for a couple weeks, and then don't go to that garden for a couple months. And then you're going to see those beautiful flowers now covered in weeds. That step is about actually reminding you to go back into that garden and weed out the weeds, pull away the weeds, water the beautiful flowers, water the beautiful things that you want to grow in your life, you know? And really take time to weed out the stuff that you don't want. You know, the word Buddha, there's many transliterations for it. There's many ways of translating it. But one translation that I love is the removal of who we're not and the development of who we are. And that's something that has like stuck with me and I love it. And that is the same metaphor about the garden. It's the last chapter is about the maintenance. It's really about like recognizing that, you know, all these challenging, aspects of ourselves, all these aspects of who we are, they are part of us, but they're not who we are. And that is what the step is about, you know? But you gotta practice. You gotta practice. You have to have devotion towards it. And just think about like how much effort you put on accumulation of stuff. How much effort you've put into accumulating stuff, into developing your greed and develop your selfishness and developing your self-cherishing, developing all the stuff that we don't like about ourselves. How much time you've put into that? Like, imagine if you've shifted the focus and you actually didn't, you know, do the things that are external, that will give you some external validation that other people will applaud you for, that you didn't put as much effort into that, but you actually put effort into developing your inner garden, your inner world, your inner sanctuary. And then you let this inner world non-verbally communicate to the world that you've changed. What would happen if you actually reintroduce yourself into the world non-verbally by the state of being? You know, what would happen from that place? Miracles. It's amazing how people are like, wow, I feel like I can tell you anything. I feel like I can, you know, let my hair down. I can show up without makeup. I can put down my guard. I can disarm myself. I can be truly me. And you didn't say a single thing. You just are existing. That is the offering of the book, is to actually get to that place where we are existing in a way that's so relaxed and everybody around us feels relaxed to be themselves too. You know, that's my hope. That's my wish. That's my offering with Spiritually Sassy.
I love your vision. I love your work. I love you really. And thank you for taking your time for this interview, for sharing with my community your wisdom, and being so relatable. Thank you so much. I put all the information to you in the show notes, of course, and I can just encourage everyone who until this point didn't know you to really follow you or get in touch with your teachings, because you radiate love like a fever. That's how I can say it. And I want to say thank you for that.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. Wow. Truly appreciate it. And it's mutual, honey. I'm like, yes, please. I want to come to Berlin. I want to see you. I want to do all the things. This song's so amazing. Thank you so much for having me Everyone listening, thank you. Thank you. Thank God for you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for choosing to live, you know, the audacity to live. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
See you later, my love.
Und vielen, vielen, vielen Dank auch an dich, dass du hier heute wieder zugehört hast. Und ich würde mich wahnsinnig freuen, wenn du Sah und mir einen Kommentar, eine Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts hinterlässt und uns wissen lässt, wie dir diese Folge gefallen hat. Und ich wünsche dir jetzt erstmal einen wunderschönen Tagabend, wo auch immer du gerade bist. Ciao.